We're still on constitutional law, and last time we finished the discussion, a general discussion of the Commerce Clause powers. Just a reminder for everybody, next week, second quiz, it's next week, and it'll only be on alternative dispute resolution and constitutional law. So what we'll finish tonight, we'll probably start property tonight, some of the property concepts, and then we'll move on from there. But the quiz will only be on those two chapters, alternative dispute resolution and constitutional law. Now, real quick rehash on some of the constitutional law principles, and then we'll get up to where we left off. Remember, four areas that are important. One is the Supremacy Clause. That's real easy. You know about that from your history classes in third grade and so on. The Constitution is the supreme law of the land. No surprise there, right? That leads to this issue of preemption. And we'll talk about that again. I'll review that very briefly in a second. The Contract Clause, Article 1, Section 10, just says that the states can't interfere with the obligations of contracts. So if a state tries to set aside a contract for whatever reason, that's not going to be honored. That won't be something the courts are going to let happen, because only the federal government can do that in the interest of national security. So the Contract Clause just gives you economic rights. Make sure that the states cannot take away your economic rights to participate in the free market system that we have. And then the big one is the Commerce Clause. Actually, well, out of all of these, Commerce Clause is the most important out of the concepts. Second most important will be what we're going to focus on tonight, which are the Bill of Rights issues. But this is important because this sets the base for all of the regulation that we're going to talk about in the third part of this course. This is where Congress gets its authority. And remember, the Commerce Clause gives Congress the power to regulate foreign commerce, absolutely. So Congress can do whatever it wants. Whether it's wise or unwise, they can do it. There's no limitation on their authority. It also grants Congress the power to regulate interstate commerce. Remember, that's commerce crossing state lines. But remember that over time, what's happened is the courts have expanded the definition of interstate commerce to include anything that affects interstate commerce. So if you're engaging in business and you're affecting the supply of a good or service, even if you're selling it only within Rhode Island, within one state, it still affects interstate commerce because it has an impact on ultimately the price and the equilibrium level of the good. So even when you're operating only within one state, because it affects interstate commerce now, generally Congress can regulate it. So the impact of that expansion that the courts gave to Congress means that basically Congress can regulate any business activity. There are very, very few things that Congress can't regulate now. And there are some limitations on this power, though. Remember, the states have an obligation. The state governments are sovereign governments, and therefore they have an obligation to protect the public health, safety, welfare, and morals. We call those police powers. They need money to do that. They need to collect some tax revenue, so they have to have the right to tax transactions. So when they engage in certain types of taxation, even if it's something that's impacting interstate commerce, it's probably okay unless we violate one of the rules over here when we look at the Commerce Clause issues. Now, when we get to the types of regulation you can have for businesses, really there are three types. Remember, everything, a lot of things come in threes. For some reason, three is a mystical number. Everything comes in threes. We can have preemption. What's preemption? It's when the federal government comes in and says, I want to be the sole source of regulation. I'm going to be the only source of regulation. All state regulation is void. That's essentially what they say. If you have a situation where we have preemption, you don't have to follow any state rules. You just ignore them, because the only rules that matter are going to be the federal rules. Now, why can we do that? Why can Congress do that? Because the Supremacy Clause grants or says that the Constitution is the supreme law of the land, and the Constitution in Article 1, Section 8 has given Congress the right to regulate interstate commerce. So if Congress clearly expresses a desire to take over regulation and be the sole source of regulation, we call that preemption, and remember, we only follow the federal rules. So here we're only following federal regulation. Now on the other side, the third one is the state regulation, state-only regulation, and that's virtually never going to happen these days because there are very few things that are solely left to the states now because of the way the courts have interpreted the definition of interstate commerce over time. But there are a few areas that are relevant. Remember, insurance is one of them. Those of you that are finance majors. If you look at insurance regulation, it's all at the state level, simply because Congress doesn't want to get involved. The states have done a good job at regulating insurance. Congress passed a bill called McCarran-Ferguson back in the 1940s, and they said that they have the right to regulate, but they're not going to because the states are doing a good enough job. And remember, or a little bit earlier, when we talked about how regulation develops, the way that Congress typically gets involved in regulating is it sees a problem. So if there's no problem, there's no need to rush in and create another federal agency and another bureaucracy to regulate something that doesn't need to be regulated. So if things are moving well, everything's fine. So insurance would be an example of this, although Congress could come in if it wanted to. The downside to this, from a business perspective, is that if we have state-only regulation, remember, you have to follow potentially 50 different sets of rules. Whenever you're operating in a particular state, the rules of that state apply. So that could increase the cost of doing business compared to a situation where we have federal preemption. We only have one set of rules to apply. It's a lot cheaper to do that. So sometimes businesses actually prefer to have Congress come in and regulate because it lowers the cost of doing business when we're complying with all that regulation. Most of the time, probably 99% of the time, when you're out there conducting business, you're going to be in dual regulation. You're going to have to follow the rules that are given to you by both the federal and the state government. And that'll happen whenever Congress says it wants to regulate but doesn't preempt, and the states also have regulation. So that's dual regulation. We have two kings. We have to follow the rules given to us by two kings, but we're going to have a few decision rules to apply to determine to what extent we have to follow all those rules. Remember, there are three of those situations, three decision rules that can come into play. This should all be reviewed, by the way. This is what we covered last time. I just want to refresh everybody's memory, and then we'll take any questions, and then we'll move on. But the three situations, first one, irreconcilable conflict. If we have an irreconcilable conflict, it's impossible to follow both rules. If you follow the federal law, you break the state. If you follow the state law, you break the federal. So it's literally impossible to comply with both rules. In that case, who wins? Federal, right? And why? Supremacy clause says the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. So it goes right back to the supremacy clause. So irreconcilable conflict's easy. We just follow federal rules. The state rules are set aside. You just ignore them. Okay, the next situation would be an undue burden on interstate commerce. This is where there's no irreconcilable conflict, but the states are trying to impose regulation that would unduly burden the free transfer of goods and people across state lines, some kind of interstate commerce. Good example of that is that airplane example I gave you, or airport example I gave you in the last class, where the mayor of Providence decides he wants to get reelected and everybody's whining and moaning about the airplanes landing at 5 in the morning. So he puts a $50,000 tax or $50,000 landing fee on airplanes that land at TF Green Airport between the hours of 5 in the morning and 10 in the morning. Is it impossible to comply with both federal and local law in that case? No, not impossible. The airport has to open at 5, say, under the FAA rules. And if the plane wants to land, they just have to pay a $50,000 landing fee, that's all. It's possible to comply with both. But does the landing fee impose a burden on interstate commerce? Yeah, because effectively it shuts down interstate commerce between the hours of 5 and 10 in the morning in Rhode Island. It prevents all of that movement of goods and services. And that's a question of fact. You're going to have to look at the facts and circumstances to make that determination. So the scales of justice are there, and you can argue. Sometimes it's kind of hard to make these determinations because they're real close. They're real close issues. But obviously, if you've got a question on an undue burden issue on an exam or on a quiz, it'd have to be pretty clear. Because I can't do it either way. It's going to be multiple choice. And the last type of dual regulation issue that we may have to deal with, it's going to be affirmative discrimination. Oh, and by the way, if there is an undue burden on interstate commerce, what rules do we follow? Fed. If there's not, if the court determines that what the state's doing is not an undue burden, what rules do we follow? Federal and state. We have to follow both. So an example of where it might not be an undue burden would be, and this was a real case, I don't know whether it was Providence or another port, but one state had tax containers coming into the port. those container ships. They said every container that goes onto or off of a ship is going to pay a $2 tax to the port. And the courts determined that that was not an undue burden on interstate commerce, so therefore you had to follow both the state and the federal regulation in that case. So that's undue burden. Now, affirmative discrimination is where we're going to be most of the time in the business world, because this is where the states try and create preferences for in-state businesses compared to out-of-state businesses. And why would they want to do that? They want their citizens working. They want their companies, their in-state companies, making lots of money because they get to tax that revenue. It's good for the state, good for the local economy, to have local businesses doing well. So some states will want to create laws that make it harder for out-of-state companies to do business in the state. Now that kind of flies in the face of the purpose of our country, right? We have all these individual states, but we have one nation. So ideally we want everybody in the country to have free access to the economic markets across the country. So when they do something like that, they may be engaging in something called affirmative discrimination against the out-of-state companies. Now just because it's discrimination doesn't mean it's bad, remember. Discrimination itself is not enough. Because if the state has a legitimate purpose for enacting the law, so there are two requirements. First one, legitimate purpose for enacting the law. And then secondly, the state has taken the minimum means necessary in order to achieve that end. So they've taken minimum means. They're not overreacting. They're doing what they absolutely have to do in order to achieve that legitimate purpose. Then, even though they're discriminating, their regulation's still going to stand. We're going to have to follow both federal and state regulation if the states meet both of these requirements. What are legitimate purposes? Well, typically it ties back to these limitations on Commerce Clause power, the police powers of the state and the right to tax. So if the state's trying to protect public health, safety, welfare, or morals, or the state's trying to collect revenue so it can run its own operations, then that's probably a legitimate purpose, and then we have to see if the state is using the minimum steps necessary in order to achieve that end. And this case, the best example of this one, great example, we went over it last time, I'm not going to go over it again in detail tonight, but the Granholm case was a perfect analysis to show you how to get through this. Because the court looked at that issue, in general looked at the issue of preemption versus state-only regulation, and then zeroed right in on this affirmative discrimination issue, looking at two different states' laws on the transfer of wine throughout the state, Michigan and New York, and it found that both states had violated the Congress's Commerce Clause power because they both tried to affirmatively discriminate against out-of-state businesses. And even what made it interesting is, remember, that New York's law had the same requirements for both in-state and out-of-state companies, but it still discriminated against out-of-state businesses because it required you to have a physical presence in New York, and it required you to buy 75% of the grapes from New York sources. And most out-of-state wineries aren't going to have the physical presence, and they really don't have a need to buy 75% of their grapes from New York, right? They can buy them from California or from France or wherever they want to get the grapes from. So even though the law applied equally to in-state and out-of-state vendors, it had a discriminatory effect and therefore was unconstitutional. So you can't just look at the law and say, well, it applies the same way to both people. That's not enough. You have to look at the impact of what the law is achieving. And if it does discriminate and the state can't meet these burdens, then it falls because it violates Congress's Commerce Clause powers. Okay? So that's where we left off. Does anybody have a question on that? Just a real quick review of these issues.
Chapter 6?
This is Chapter 6. I think it's Chapter 6. It's constitutional law. This is going to be on the test, or not test, but quiz next time. So any questions on how this works? It's pretty methodical. Once you get the basic premises down, if you just step through the analysis, you should be able to come to the conclusions. Okay? And you want to see how to do it? Look at Granholm versus Heels. That's what the cases are for, remember. Cases show you how to apply these things so that when you get a different set of facts, you can do the same thing. All right? Questions? Last chance, anybody?
Yeah.
Nobody? Everybody's got it down? I'm boring you? Hopefully I'm boring you. That means you all know this. Then I don't have to worry about the next quiz will be easy to grade. A lot easier to grade quizzes that everybody does well on than when they do elsewise. Okay. All right. That's it for Commerce Clause. All right. Let's move on to the Bill of Rights. This is where we have to pick up tonight with the material Bill of Rights. We're only going to really cover two provisions of the Bill of Rights, and then we're going to talk briefly about the 14th Amendment. The reason why we're including the 14th Amendment in this, Bill of Rights is only the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, but we're going to include the 14th Amendment because it's typically read in conjunction with the 5th Amendment. And there are some legal issues that have to be dealt with that tie these two together, so we'll cover both. But the First Amendment is one that is going to apply to business in a lot of respects. We saw an example right at the beginning of this class with that little case that you got to witness. First Amendment deals with rights of religion, press, speech, and assembly. Those are the big four. For religion, press, speech, and assembly. Now, why should we care about religion in a business law class? Well, as you saw in that case, religion can become an issue. If we're hiring people and we're violating certain religious rights, the company could potentially be liable. And this is something that human resources and management people need to know about when they're hiring and firing and making decisions about what certain people are going to be doing. So let's talk about that right to freedom of religion in a little bit more detail. The freedom of religion comes in two forms, really. There are two clauses that deal with freedom of religion in the First Amendment. And the first clause is something called the Establishment Clause. And all that says is that the state cannot establish a religion. And that was almost unheard of back in the 1700s when this stuff came around. Even today, most states have an official state religion. You go to Spain, it's Catholicism. You go to England, it's the Church of England. If you go to other countries, you'll have official religions. So the United States can't have that, because the Establishment Clause prohibits the government from establishing a state religion. That's easy. We know that Congress can't force religious beliefs on people, so that's a good thing. Have any of you been to the National Cathedral in Washington, by chance? Any of you seen that? It's kind of a neat place, isn't it? Because in there, when you go in, you'll see iconology for many different religions. It's not just Christian, not just Jewish, not just Muslim, not just Hindu, but you'll see iconology that relates to all of the major world religions. Now, why do you think that they would do that? Congress paid to construct that National Cathedral. Originally, that was supposed to be our version of Westminster Abbey. They thought that all the presidents were going to be buried there. And I guess only Woodrow Wilson took him up on that. So he's the only president buried in the National Cathedral. All the rest of them wanted to go back home when they died. So it didn't quite work out. But if Congress had paid for the construction of that cathedral and put only Christian symbols, for example, in the cathedral, what could that be construed as? Establishment of religion. So they couldn't do it. So Establishment Clause is pretty easy. Now the more important one is the Free Exercise Clause. Free exercise. You have a constitutional right, a fundamental right as a human being to freely exercise your religion. Now, remember that whenever you have rights, generally you can exercise those rights up to the point where they start to infringe on somebody else's rights. So there are going to be limitations on this. Just because you have the right in the Constitution to do something doesn't mean it's unlimited. And I should mention that as well, that when we're talking about these Bill of Rights issues, the ability to engage in certain activities actually kind of ebbs and flows. At some times it's very broad, and at other times we crack down on it, we limit those rights a little bit. Before 9/11, for example, the courts and Congress was very liberal in granting everybody the right to engage in those fundamental rights that are preserved in the Bill of Rights. But after 9/11, what happened? We were under attack, or at least that's what we perceived to be under attack, and we needed to crack down on some of those rights to protect society. So that some of the privacy rights, some of the free exercise rights, and so on, those things were eroded a little bit because the government needed to take action to protect society as a whole against the perceived threats that they saw from those 9/11 attacks. Now, you may agree or may not agree with that, and especially if you look at something like the Patriot Act. Patriot Act itself is probably an oxymoron. right? Many of the patriots that got us our freedom will probably be turning around like a barbecue spit, rolling around in their graves if they saw some of the provisions in that Patriot Act. But it's an example of where the government tightens up on some of those rights. So let's go back to religion. Let's say that I want to practice my religion, and my religion calls for human sacrifice. Can I do it? Can I put somebody out on the table and rip out their heart? No, I can't do that. Why? Because it's now affecting somebody else's rights. If I ascribe to a religion that calls for smoking marijuana to commune with God, what do you think about that? Does the government have to let me smoke pot so that I can freely practice my religion? Why not? You're right, they don't have to let me do it, and they prevent people from doing this, but why not? Why shouldn't they let me do that? What's the government trying to do by ruling out use of marijuana, cocaine, things like that? What are they exercising? It's right in front of you. What's the government doing? It's right on the board. It's exercising police power, right? So in a sense, it's regulating commerce, but it's also exercising police power because it's protecting the public health, safety, welfare, and morals. So when they say you shouldn't be smoking pot, there's a reason for that. Today we think of marijuana as kind of a good drug, right? A lot of people think it's not a problem, but some people that smoke marijuana never get out of the hallucinogenic state that it puts them in. So after a few experiences with marijuana, you may hear voices for the rest of your life. You may get those visions for the rest of your life. And so the government has an obligation to protect people against that kind of thing, so that's what they're doing. So that's a limitation there as well. So remember, whenever you see government limitations on rights, usually those limitations are there to protect other people. And that's how things come in. Now, in employment discrimination, we have a big issue, because when you're hiring people, you obviously cannot hire people or fire people on the basis of their religion. So I can't hire people or fire people because they're Christian or Jewish or Muslim or Hindu or anything else. Now, usually we don't see too much of a problem there, but in this example that we saw here, we have somebody wanting to freely exercise her religion, right? But the uniform policy of the company would prohibit that. So if she knew in advance that she couldn't wear the headscarf, but she took the job, would the company be discriminating against her? No, wouldn't be discriminating against her because nobody's forcing her to take the job. Right? She knows that that's a requirement of working, so if it's a requirement, then it's a requirement. That's not discrimination on the basis of religion. It doesn't become discrimination on the basis of religion simply because the requirements of a job violate certain religious precepts. If you know them in advance and you agree to them, you're making a contract. You're obligated under the contract. Now, in this case, she probably didn't know about them. And how many times do you think a manager of a fast food hamburger flipping restaurant is going to sit down and go over the employee manual in detail with the people they hire? Have any of you worked in fast food restaurants? Do they do that? No. No. Are you willing to come in? Here's what you're going to get paid an hour. There's the uniform. Go put it on and get behind the counter, right? They don't waste a lot of time going over this. So that was probably an ambiguity there that can cause an issue. Now let me give you a few other examples where religion can come into play using a couple of real cases. One of them was a case from the early 1980s, and I know you're all too young to remember this, but you may have heard of the hostage crisis that we had with Iran, when the Shah was overthrown and the Ayatollah Khomeini came in and held all of the people in our embassy hostage in Iran. Well, there was a person working at a bakery in the United States who was of Iranian descent. And he was not Muslim, but he was of Iranian descent. He looked like a Middle Easterner and so on. And all the people at the bakery used to refer to him as the Ayatollah. This was when all this stuff was going on in Iran. They called him the Ayatollah. And he was very uncomfortable with that because it wasn't, first of all, he wasn't Muslim. And secondly, he felt offended that people were referring to him in that way. So he told his supervisor about it. Supervisor thought it was funny. Didn't think there was any problem with it. Here you have an Iranian. A lot of people over here thought Iranians were Ayatollahs. So what's the problem? Well, this harassment kept going on. He ultimately wound up quitting, and then he sued the employer. Do you think there's a cause of action? Does he win when he sues? This was a real case. How many say yes? Nobody? Okay, a few of you. How many say no? All right. About half and half, it looks like. In the real case, he won. He won on the basis of religious discrimination and harassment. Now, why would that happen? Why do you think a court would say that he should win? By the way, this is the same issue that we see when we get to employment law and we talk about things like sexual harassment. Same exact thing is applying. It's creating a hostile work environment, in this case on the basis of religion, because they're using religious positions to harass somebody. So that was a problem. Now let me give you another hypothetical. This would be hypothetical, but let's just say that I'm an agnostic person, and there's nothing I enjoy doing more than poking at the people that are very religious. I like to get them revved up. So I have this company, and I run it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, year round. It makes some kind of industrial product. We just have all these machines running constantly, things going through the process constantly. So what I decide to do is I'm going to make all the Jewish people work on Saturday. I'm going to make all the Christian people work on Sunday. I'm going to make all the Muslim people work at night, because during Ramadan, I don't know if any of you are familiar with this, but during Ramadan, Muslim people can't eat during the day. So I'm going to make them all work at night, and I'm not going to give them a break to eat. So they can't eat during the day, they can't eat when they're at work. So I get to play around with them a little bit. What do you think? Can I do it? And by the way, this is a completely private company. I have no government contracts. I'm in no way connected with the government at all. Can I do that? If they don't like it, they can leave. Right? I can't force them to stay. So if they don't like it, they can quit. Then they won't have to work on Saturday or Sunday or at night. What do you think? Can I get away with it? It's a horrible thing to do, right? Certainly not a very nice way of treating your employees, and in the long run it probably wouldn't help you very much, because ultimately you wouldn't have a lot of employees if you keep doing stuff like that. But can I get away with it? Why not?
Because you're obviously looking at their specific religions and saying, based on your judgment.
Okay, so in that case, I'm literally making my decisions based on the free exercise of these individuals' religious beliefs, right? So even though I'm a private employer, I'm still going to be required to make sure I give reasonable accommodation to the employees so that they can freely exercise their rights. I can't take those rights away. That's a fundamental right. It's hard-coded in the Constitution. I can't force the Jewish people to work on Saturday if I can make a reasonable accommodation and perhaps have them work on Sunday. So I make the Jewish people work on Sunday, I make the Christian people work on Saturday. Right? The factory is still running. Does it cost me anything to make the change? Doesn't cost me anything to make the change, plus I'm allowing all my employees now to freely exercise their religious beliefs. So that's what we call reasonable accommodation. Employers are required to make reasonable accommodations to allow their employees to freely exercise their religion. Now, let me change the facts a little bit. Question?
Well, I was going to say, there's a company in Philadelphia, I think, and every day they require their employees to take like 10 minutes, like all the departments gather in a circle and have 10 minutes of prayer.
Okay.
And it's like the largest employer in Philadelphia.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, they may announce that in advance. They may say when you interview for that job that, by the way, every day the first 10 minutes we all have group prayer. It's probably, my guess is it's probably not one denomination or one religion. It's probably a generic.
It's a private company and the family that owns it is like very
right.
Openly religious.
Right. But it's probably not, it's probably generic. The prayer is probably fairly generic, right? Because most religions believe in God. Most religion people who ascribe to religion believe in God, right? So if you have a prayer that talks about God but doesn't limit the tradition to maybe Jewish or Christian or Muslim, right? You might be able to get away with that, and especially if you announce that in advance, it's probably okay. And if any of you have gone to religious schools, anybody go to middle school or high school? Religious schools, well, you do that there, right? Not only there, they make you go to services and things like that when you go to those kinds of schools. Why can they do that? Because you're voluntarily choosing to attend that school knowing that those are requirements that you're going to have to fulfill. So as long as you know in advance, that could be a condition. But it's a little bit different.
The high school that I went to, like, because I'm Jewish, there's all different, like, Reform, like whatever.
Right. Yeah, Reform and traditional conservative.
So, like, you did have options, like what you wanted to go to. I usually just skipped it, but like you could have, like there were options of like maybe this company like has options. Of, like,
yeah, maybe they had different groups for different religions.
Yeah.
Right. They did that, but they wanted to foster that belief in God. And speaking of this issue, what about things like the Pledge of Allegiance? We talked about that a little bit earlier, right? In that case, a little bit earlier, when the words under God. Why do the courts allow the Pledge of Allegiance to include the words under God? Because how is the country formed? Who colonized this area originally? All the religious fanatics. Basically, this the New World was founded by people who had a firm belief in some deity. So saying under God doesn't really violate the traditions of any one religion. It's kind of generic in a sense. But they allow that because of the traditional or the historical association with the people who founded and colonized the what's now the United States. So kind of interesting there. All right, now let me go back to that example one more time. Let's say that one where I was trying to harass all the different religions, right? Let's say I don't want to harass all the religions, but I have this factory that literally runs 7 days a week, and it runs in 24 hours a day, and one of my workers dies. So I have an opening. I need to fill that opening so that I can continue to produce my goods and services. And that work week starts on Sunday, and it goes through Friday, or Thursday. And then Friday and Saturday is kind of the weekend for that position. And I advertise that I have this opening and that the work week is Sunday through Thursday, and that anybody who wants to can apply. And somebody comes along and they apply, and I tell them in the interview, I said it in the ad, the requirement is you work the shifts from Sunday through Thursday. Can they accept the job and then 2 minutes later come into the personnel manager's office and say, oh, by the way, I'm a born-again Christian and I can't work on Sunday, so I'll just be showing up Monday through Thursday? Can they do that? Why? What's the difference between that and the first example that I gave you where I was just forcing everybody to work at times when they should have been observing their religious beliefs?
Because the person... Knowing. Work
right. Right. So nobody forced this person to take that job. They knew the requirements, and if they wanted to waive their religious requirements, they could do so to take the job. If they don't want to waive the religious requirements, they can go apply for some other job. So the situation changes a little bit when you're up front and you display the requirements. So what this all boils down to, and we'll talk more about this when we get to employment law, you've got to be very specific about expectations, especially when work expectations might in some way interfere with somebody's right to exercise their religion. You've got to be very specific about that to protect yourself, protect the company, and protect the rights of the employee who's being hired. So that all goes to freedom of religion. Now, let's talk about freedom of press next, freedom of the press. This is actually, sometimes it's referred to as the fourth branch of government. And it's not really a fourth branch, but it really is part of the checks and balances system. We have the three branches of government. All those branches of government are supposed to look at each other, make sure that none of them get too far out of whack. But the problem is all three of the branches are the government. There's nobody from the outside looking in and checking up on what those three branches of government are doing. So the reason why we have freedom of the press in this country is not because we want to give economic opportunities to people who want to produce the tabloids like the National Enquirer and those kinds of things. It's really to provide a check on governmental action, an independent check on what the government's doing. Because if you're a congressman or a senator, the last thing you want is some dirty deal that you're involved with showing up on the front page of your local newspaper, right? But the local newspaper has an incentive to expose the dirty deal because that's something relevant for the people in that district to know about before they vote for you, whether or not you're going to return to Washington. So really it's there as a check and a balance, and that's not true in most of the world. Most of the world there is government censorship in some form. Even in Europe, in many areas of Europe, there is censorship of what shows up on the news, the nightly news. Now, it's more prominent in places like the old Soviet bloc, but even in England, you go over to England, England has lots of rights. People there have lots of rights, but when the Queen's Jubilee was being run, there were some people, this was the first Jubilee, the 25-year Jubilee, there was a rock group that had rented a boat, and they wanted to sail up and down the Thames playing anti-patriotic songs, things that were not very nice about the Queen. And they were rounded up and put in jail for the weekend, so they couldn't do that. Because the government could censor what was presented. The government can censor what goes out into the press. Now, in the United States, we can't censor, but we do not protect people that make statements in the press from the consequences of their action. So what we can't do is we can't impose what's called a prior restraint on free speech. So the government can't say, don't put that in the newspaper. They can't do it. They literally cannot do it. But if you put something in the newspaper that has the effect of harming someone else, guess what? You're going to be liable. Now that's what we call defamation. We'll talk more about defamation in specific terms when we get to tort law. But there are two different types of defamation. There's libel and slander. Libel is written defamation. It's something that comes out in a newspaper or in a recorded medium like a television show, because that's taped, or a radio show that's taped. So that's recorded. That would be libel. And slander is when I just say something nasty about someone. It's just an oral statement. So if I say something about someone that is not true and causes harm to them, then they can sue me and they can collect damages. Because if it caused harm, there are actual damages that they suffered. And they're entitled to compensation for those damages. So kind of a neat thing. So if I walk into a classroom and I say that Jane Doe is a slut, and that has some kind of impact on Jane Doe's ability to get a job, she can sue me. That's slander. If I put it in the newspaper, National Enquirer, I have a front page article, Jane Doe is a slut. Right? You laugh, but look at those things in the grocery store the next time you're there. That's essentially what they say. They come out with these ridiculous claims. But I put that in the press, and National Enquirer is constantly getting sued by all of the celebrities. They're always suing National Enquirer because they're not true statements, and they have the potential to cause harm. Now, you have to show that it causes harm. You have to literally be able to show damages. And we'll talk about that when we get to the specific types of law where you can sue for this. But that's important. Now, if you're a public official, we have another standard that applies. For most of us are private citizens. So all we'd have to show, if somebody said something in the press or in exercising their free speech rights that was untrue and hurt us monetarily, not feelings. Feelings don't count. Or somebody's dead. If I say Jane Doe's a slut and Jane Doe's been dead for 20 years, what damages am I causing? None. Because she has no economic rights anymore. Right? So it's still a nasty thing to say, but there are no damages, so there's no recovery. But if you're a public official, remember what the purpose of the press is to do what? Criticize the government. It's to come in and check governmental action. So in addition to showing that the statement is untrue, and showing that there are damages, you have to show that the person acted with actual malice in order to get a recovery, if it's a public official. So there's a higher standard for public officials.
Can that go against businesses too? So if someone, like I own a store, someone comes into my store, you know, they something happens to them that they don't like, they say they're going to go outside and stand in front of the store and say that, you know, I kill babies or, you know, something ridiculous, so that people won't want to come into my store.
Sure.
I can sue.
You can sue for slander. Yeah. You can sue for slander. Now, you can't stop them from saying it. You can stop them from saying it on your property, but they could stand across the street and say that. And if you could show that that was actually deterring people from coming into your store and you were losing business, you could sue if you could show that it was a false statement. Sure.
What about, like, dead celebrities? If their families still get income, like, from books or music?
Right. Now, that's a little bit different, because if you have somebody that is still generating an income stream, a posthumous income stream, we call it, then that could be an issue. So there could be actual financial damages. And especially since this is a business law course, when we talk about damages, generally the courts want to give you financial damages. They don't want to have all these wacky type things you hear about all the time on TV and some of the shows. They're really trying to look for the specific economic damages. So if you can, let's say I go out and I say Elvis had illegitimately fathered 256 babies or something like that, and it has some kind of impact on the ability of Elvis's estate to collect income and royalties, and then there could be damages. Sure.
How can the FCC fine people for swearing? It's not really viable.
Okay.
I mean, who cares if I swear on the radio? It's not hurting anyone.
Well, that's a good issue. That deals with the censorship of what we call filthy words. That's what it's called in government parlance. Filthy words. And I guess there are 7 things that you're not allowed to say. And I'm not going to repeat them here, but I think you all know what they are. So you can't say those filthy words over the airways. Why not? Why should the government be able to put a prior restraint on that? What would you argue? Okay, police powers. It goes right back to the obligation the government has to protect the public health, safety, welfare, morals, right? Now, do any of you have Sirius satellite radio? A few of you have that. And if you have that, you know you can listen to Howard Stern, right? And Howard Stern uses all 7 of those words on a fairly regular basis, doesn't he? On the Sirius satellite radio. Now, why can he get away with doing that there, where regular FM station that I can tune into up here, they're going to censor those words? What's the difference between the two? Okay, you're paying for the service, and what does that imply? Okay, your choice to listen to it, that's one thing.
Not everybody can, because like, if you just turn on the radio, a regular radio, like anyone can hear it.
Anyone can hear it. So who's going to hear that kind of stuff on a regular radio? Kids. If kids start hearing that kind of language, that's not good. That doesn't protect the public morals. So the state's exercising its police powers in that respect. And with Sirius, if the parents are going to let the kids have the Sirius radio and they're intentionally exposing the children to that, that's fine. That's a parental choice that can be made. But we don't just want to have it publicly available so that we can corrupt young minds, right? That's what it gets to.
Well, also with that, with the Howard Stern radio and the Playboy radio, like when you activate your subscription, they ask if you want those channels.
Yeah. Yeah, they ask you specifically. So you're opting in to that, and therefore there's no need to censor at that point, because there's no, you're choosing it. That's the choice that you have.
So I'm like, is that choice to like not show nudity, for instance, like during prime time? Is that a choice that the cable company makes, or is that federal?
Well, on broadcast TV, they can't show nudity for the same reason. We don't want young children to be exposed to that type of behavior and so on. So it's okay if adults consent to it.
It's like on cable, you can't, like, they censor a lot of things.
Yeah.
Like violence.
Yeah.
Gore.
Yeah. Yeah. So even on cable, you're paying for cable, but even there, probably, my guess is if you order certain channels, you're going to get a lot of that kind of stuff, right? But most of cable, you're not going to see a lot of that, because most people have cable now. So cable companies are not just going to put all the antics of the, all those types of antics on TV because the kids could get a hold of it. It could become an issue. Okay? Everybody got the points there? All right, good. So press, speech. Let me talk about speech a little bit more because speech is kind of interesting. Speech is not only what comes out of my mouth. I'm speaking right now. I have freedom of speech. You have freedom of speech. You can tell me whatever you want. I can tell you whatever I want. Right? That's freedom of speech. That's nice. But that's not the only way we can express ourselves. We can also engage in symbolic speech. And we see this in a few business applications as well as other approaches. But let me give you a generic approach first. Let's say that back in the 1980s, Texas passes a law that says you can't burn the United States flag. This actually happened. They passed a law, said you can't burn the flag, and they made it a felony to do so, a third-degree felony. They'll put you in jail if you burn the U.S. flag. Now, this guy named Johnson, now how many Johnsons do you think live in Texas? Texas is a big state, right? There are probably a lot of people with the name Johnson in Texas. Johnson didn't like the law, didn't think the law was passing constitutional muster. So let's say that he wants to take some action. So he sends out a bunch of press releases and tells all the local TV stations and radio stations that he's going to have a press conference on the steps of the courthouse to talk about the unconstitutionality of this Texas law. How many of those TV stations and radio stations are going to show up? Think any of them are? They're going to look at this, oh, who's this guy Johnson? Shh. Throw out the thing. Nobody's going to come. So what he did instead was he went to the courthouse steps, lined up a bunch of American flags and torched them all. Got arrested. The sheriff came, arrested him. They convicted him on felony charges, put him in jail. This case went all the way up to the Supreme Court. What are we dealing with in this case? What kind of issue? Freedom of speech. That's symbolic speech. Why did he burn the flags? Did he burn the flags because he hates the United States? No, he was burning the flags to demonstrate his disagreement with the Texas law. And that was the only way he could get enough attention to that for the press and the public to take notice. So this goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court rules that's protected speech. So when you do something that's intended to express an idea, that's protected as much as the words coming out of my mouth. That's an example of speech, and it's fully protected under the First Amendment. How do they determine it wasn't to get attention? See, the burden of proof would be on who? The government. If it's a criminal case, particularly a criminal case, the government has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. So when he did that, he was burning the flags to make the point that this law was inappropriate. Now, we can relate this to something we learned about in the very beginning of this course. To get into court, could Johnson have just ran into the United States Supreme Court and said, "Your Honors, I don't think this law is constitutional. I want to challenge the constitutional validity of this statute." What would they say? Get out. Why would they say get out? No case or controversy. Right? There's no case or controversy. So how do we get a case or controversy? Burn the flags, violate the law, get arrested, and get sentenced. Now we have a case or controversy, and now we can bring it up to the Supreme Court and get a decision. So that's what was really going on in that kind of a case. Okay? Now you question?
Didn't the court also say that even if he had done it in malice, it wouldn't have mattered as long as that there wasn't a threat to the public?
Right.
Just the fact that he was burning it, yep, didn't matter at all.
Right.
If he didn't just express an idea, even if he didn't hate America, and people started rioting, then it could be considered.
Right. Now, if he did it to incite a riot, or he did it to create a public disturbance, then there could certainly be governmental action against him. But that wasn't really why he was doing it. He was doing it to make the point about that case. Now, you brought up another thing that really goes to the symbolic speech issue. You mentioned things like nudity on television and so on. Obviously, the government, the FCC, regulates that, doesn't want that shown. But when you see these cases pop up on occasion in towns. I don't know if any of you might have seen these in your local communities, but somebody wants to come in and put in a bar that has, what do they call it, exotic entertainment in the bar. And of course, the local town doesn't want anything to do with us. They don't want that kind of thing in their town. So they say, you can't set up the bar. What do they sue the town on the basis of? They say that they're violating what? Freedom of expression. It's a speech issue, freedom of speech. And it's artistic speech in that case, if you want to call that artistic, but that's what they say. Now this comes up on occasion when even in movies, for example, when something might be shown in a public forum, if it's obscene, if something's deemed to be obscene, you can regulate it. The government can say, we're not going to permit this to be shown in a public forum because the content is obscene. Now, how do we determine what's obscene? Anybody know? Ask it to court, right? Goes to court, and there's a little movie theater in the Supreme Court, and all the justices go down and they look at these things and they determine whether or not it's obscene or not. So they weigh these things. And it's when you start talking about symbolic speech, it's tough because you've got to weigh the interests of the individual who wants to engage in the speech against the needs of society to protect public health, safety, welfare, and morals. So there's a weighing there, and a lot of times these issues are very, very close. They're very close, so it's tough sometimes to predict how those cases are going to be decided. But all this wraps up in the idea of free speech. Now, when we talked about symbolic speech, there are four requirements that the government has to meet in order to regulate symbolic speech. And I just want to point these out. You should be able to recognize these. I won't ask you to memorize them, but if you see them in questions, you should be able to recognize which of these are requirements. Or if you see an essay question, for example, on a midterm exam or something, you should be able to do that. And that would be take-home anyway, so you can look it up. But first of all, the first requirement, if the government wants to regulate symbolic speech, is the regulation has to be consistent with the power of the government. The government has to have the right to do it. Usually they're going to have the right because they're exercising police power. So that's an easy one to overcome in most cases. Secondly, it has to further an important or substantial government interest. So it can't be just a governmental interest. It has to be something that's important and or substantial. So there has to be some real reason why. It can't be just that some right-wing wacko has gotten in control and thinks that anybody that says the word damn is a horrible person and we need to censor that. That's not going to pass muster. It has to be a very important or substantial governmental interest. It has to be unrelated to the suppression of speech. The purpose of the regulation can't be to shut down the speech. It has to go to something else, like regulating health, safety, welfare, and morals. And then finally, the regulation itself has to be no greater than necessary to produce the results. Because whenever we're dealing with a fundamental right, the government has to take minimum action to achieve the result. They can't just say, oh, well, this will achieve it, but it'll also achieve all these other things that we want to regulate, but we're going to say that the regulation's really there to do this. Because that gives the government too much authority. So they have to narrowly tailor the regulation so that it specifically addresses that one issue. That makes sense? So those are the four requirements. That's in your textbook. I just want to point that out. Now, for marketing majors, we have something called commercial speech, commercial free speech. If you go back 30 or 40 years, there was no such thing as commercial speech before the 60s, late 60s, early 70s. Commercial speech didn't exist. It wasn't recognized. A corporation had no free speech rights. Now, a corporation has limited free speech rights. This is obviously important for marketing people because what are you doing? If you're in marketing, what are you doing? You're promoting your products. So you're advertising, you're talking about how great your products are. You want to be able to do that. You want to have the right to do it. Now, traditionally, corporations have advertised products. This really went to professionals in the past. Professionals could not advertise. If you were a physician or an accountant or a lawyer, or an architect, you couldn't advertise. Not only was it considered ethically bad, it was legally prohibited. You just couldn't do it. But then in the late 60s, early 70s, some people started to sue. Some of the lawyers decided that that their right to participate in the free market was being impeded because they couldn't exercise their free speech rights and put up billboards all over town that said, if you have you slipped on your neighbor's sidewalk, call me and sue for the maximum money damages the law will allow, right? Have those TV commercials on and so on. So the Supreme Court agreed with them, and now even lawyers and doctors, you see a lot of plastic surgeons advertising, and even sometimes accountants or other professionals now advertise. That's all because of these commercial free speech rights that have developed over time. So they're limited. The government can restrict these if it's necessary to protect public health, safety, welfare, and morals. So we keep on going back to this police power issue, but generally you have the right to engage in that type of commercial free speech. And then the last thing that the First Amendment covers is freedom of information. And some of you may be familiar with this concept. The government is supposed to be a government of the people, right? But obviously, you can't find out what's going on. You can't just walk into the White House and say, I want to sit in the Situation Room and see whether George is doing a good job this day. Right? You can't do that. Why? Because there are national security interests at stake. So there are state secrets. Things are kept secret and private and top secret and all these kinds of things. Well, eventually, all that information is publicly available. And you have a right as a citizen to access any information that's not vital to the interests of the state and that the state has to keep secret for either national security or foreign relations purposes. So that's freedom of information. Okay, so that's the First Amendment. Now, these two, the press is kind of the override. If you look at these last three, the press is kind of the overriding issue. Speech is a special type of freedom of the press, in a sense. And the right to assembly is a big one in business. Because if you deal with a union, if you work for a company that has unions, unions have a little bit of a temper sometimes, and they stop working. And then they go march around with picket signs and talk about how they're being unfairly dealt with and so on. So they have a right to assemble. Can you stop a union from assembling and picketing your business? Let's say you can't agree with the union on wages or terms of employment. We'll talk about all of that, union management relations, when we get to human resources a little bit later. But can you stop the union from picketing your business? Absolutely not. Now, what you can do is you can stop them from closing down. They can't just blockade the entrance to the factory or stop people from going in and out of the factory. They can't do that kind of stuff. But they have the right to peaceably assemble, maybe across the street, within certain confines. They may have to get permits to do this. There are different requirements locally and so on. But they may have to get the permits, but they have the right to do that. You can't stop them from engaging in that activity because that's a form of symbolic speech, and it's protected under the First Amendment. Okay, so unions, we'll talk a lot more about that in human resources law a little bit later in the regulation section. All right, any other questions there? No? All right, let's talk about the Fifth Amendment then. Fifth Amendment you already know about. Every time you turn on the TV and you see a cop show or a court show, what are people doing? They plead the what? The Fifth. And what does pleading the Fifth mean? What does that mean?
You don't have to say anything with incrimination.
Right. You have a right to not incriminate yourself because the burden of proof is on the government, right? The government has to prove that you engaged in some kind of criminal activity if they want to take action against you. So pleading the Fifth, that's what we usually hear of with the Fifth Amendment. The Fifth Amendment's a little bit broader than that, though, because it governs other areas of criminal behavior. One thing it does is it gives you the right to grand jury proceedings. Now, in the beginning part of the course, we talked about court process, and we talked about the petite jury. The petite jury is the one that sits in the case and listens to all the witnesses and comes to a verdict that the judge either enters or sets aside at the end of the case. So the petite jury is actually listening to a specific case. A grand jury has a much different function. Excuse me. A grand jury is there to put a check on the prosecutor's discretion. The prosecutor cannot bring a criminal action to court without permission of a grand jury. So if the prosecutor wants to charge you with a crime, the prosecutor first has to convince the grand jury that it's fair to put you on trial. So they have to provide enough evidence to indicate that it's likely that you committed the crime, and it wouldn't be unfair to force you to stand trial. Now, the reason we do this is really a historical reason. In the old days in merry old England, especially during King Charles I's reign, which was a little bit before our independence from England, but back in the 1500s, Charles used to have something called the Star Chamber. And if you were not a friend of the crown, one morning at about 3 o'clock in the morning, you might be woken up by some guards who would drag you out of your house and bring you to the Star Chamber, and there'd be a judge there, and no jury, just a judge, and there'd be an executioner right outside, so that right after they did this little 20-minute trial, immediate justice, whap, head goes off, and everything's taken care of. Now, what do you think the problem with that is? It doesn't give you notice. It doesn't give you fair opportunity to represent yourself. It doesn't give you opportunity to get people to help you defend yourself. And also, it allows the prosecutor, it allows the people that are making the decisions about who to have arrested and who to bring to trial, it gives them too much power. And historically, in the past, prosecutors have used that power at times for inappropriate purposes like trying to get themselves reelected. Now, there was a modern example of this just a couple years ago. Some of you have probably followed this. Anybody remember what happened down at Duke, South Carolina, or North Carolina? What happened at Duke? And what am I talking about? A couple years ago. Anybody know? Yeah, the lacrosse team, they had a little party, and there was a stripper there, and the stripper said that the lacrosse team had sexually assaulted her and had done all these nasty things to her. And originally, it looked like they might have been guilty. So they were charged with all these crimes, and the prosecutor was going gung-ho to try and prosecute these college students, about your age, for engaging in this illicit behavior. Now, when the prosecutor was doing this, the prosecutor was up for election that November. So why do you think the prosecutor was so interested in getting these kids from Duke prosecuted and maybe found guilty on this, so he could appear to be tough on crime, right? So he could go to the electorate and say, I'm doing my job, I'm not letting these spoiled little brats going to Duke get off the hook just because they are going to a prestigious university. I'm equally enforcing the law. The problem was that all the evidence indicated that they didn't do what they were charged with doing. And all the DNA evidence, everything, everything exonerated. All the evidence tended to exonerate these students. Does anybody know what happened as a result of this? You know what the end result was? What? Okay, the prosecutor got disbarred. Anything else happened? Okay, he got sued civilly, and that's still pending. So he's basically going to be broke for life by the time that civil suit's over. So he got sued civilly, and he lost his license, got disbarred. He could never practice law again, and he went to jail because he used the state, an office of the state, for his own personal gain. And what's even worse, probably in this case for this guy, anybody know what his name is? Nifong. And in legal circles now, when somebody's getting railroaded by the prosecution, we now call that being Nifong. So 200 years from now, people are going to be talking about getting Nifong. This guy's name is going to go down in history as the example of what a prosecutor should not be doing. But that's really what the grand jury is designed to prevent. Because if the prosecutor's acting in an inappropriate way and is trying to affect your rights, the grand jury should say, no, you don't have enough evidence, you don't have enough probative evidence to bring this to trial. It's not fair to force these people to stand trial. So that's what the grand jury does. Any of you been called for grand jury, by the way? Anybody? No? I had a student last year, as a senior, be called for grand jury service. Now that's even worse than regular jury service. I know a few of you have been called for regular jury service. That's usually a few days or a week, if you get called for a regular jury. If you get called for a grand jury, it's 3 months. Because you hear every case that the prosecutor wants to bring for a 3-month period. So it's a long stint. Luckily, we were able to get him out of it because he wouldn't have been able to graduate last year if he had to go to the grand jury right at the beginning of his senior year. Wouldn't have been too good. But if you get called for jury duty, hope you don't get called for the grand jury, because you'll be spending a lot of time with the prosecutors. Huh?
You have to sit there even if it's one to one case.
Yeah. You have multiple cases. You will hear every case the prosecutor wants to bring to court over that period of time. So.
How did they prove that he was doing it for his benefit?
Well, he completely disregarded all the evidence. And even in light of all the evidence exonerating those students, he was still pursuing that case as if they were the perpetrators, and he was trying to throw the book at them. So just his actions, in light of the evidence, showed that he was acting in an inappropriate way. So he suffered a lot of consequences. He should have. That's an inappropriate use of the legal system and an inappropriate use of his position as a public official.
So if you get called to the grand jury, like, how does that work? Because obviously you can't work for those 3 months.
Yeah.
So do they, like, pay you?
Well, if you work for someone else, they still have to pay you. And the jury, the court pays you something like $15 a day, and they give you a free lunch.
So your employer still has
to
pay you.
And sometimes free parking, too. But not all the time. So, but basically what happens, you have to give the $15 to your employer, and your employer still has to pay you. The bigger problem is for people that are self-employed, because...
Don't they just let you out of that?
Nope.
My mom was on it for 3 months.
And she was self-employed? Yeah.
No.
Oh, yeah, so she... Okay,
like
so
they, her work paid for it.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah, there were people that were on it that couldn't get their work to pay for it or something like that. Maybe they were self-employed.
They might have been self-employed. Yeah, because if you're, let's say you run your own business, and you get called for that, that's a big problem, isn't it? Because you, if you're the business, you're not there to run it, you've got to be there for jury duty, that's a big burden. So, but usually if you're employed by someone else, they have to continue to pay.
Is that like the regular jury where you can like move it back? Like I know like regular jury you can like move it back to the school or like up your way, but like the grand jury you can like defer it like a year?
Sometimes. Yeah, sometimes you can. Grand juries are there. Sometimes you might sit in a grand jury for one case. And a good example of that, anybody know Scooter Libby? Who Scooter Libby is? He was the chief of staff for the vice president. And about 3 years ago now, he was indicted after a year and a half grand jury inquest. So that grand jury sat for a year and a half on one and only one case. And that was that Scooter Libby case. So, and by the way, the grand jury proceedings are secret, they can't be divulged, the attorneys can't say what happened in the grand jury, the grand jurors can't say what happened, and if you do, you go to jail. So they take that very seriously. So it's not something that goes to guilt or innocence, it just says that it's either fair or not fair to bring you to trial. That's really what it's looking at. So the evidence that's presented there isn't quite up to snuff with the evidentiary requirements at a trial. Now, the other thing that the Fifth Amendment does is it gives us protection against double jeopardy. Now, double jeopardy means you can't be tried for the same crime twice by the same governmental entity. So if you get charged with a federal crime and you win the case, you get acquitted, the federal government can't charge you again. However, the state government can charge you again. Because that's a different government. So double jeopardy applies on a per government basis. And this happens all the time in criminal proceedings. A lot of times the states and the feds will work together. And one will try the person they think was guilty of something. And if they don't get them, well then the other government will try them. It's not double jeopardy because it's not the same government proceeding against the individual. Double jeopardy only applies to criminal matters. It does not extend to civil matters. So it only applies in criminal cases. Okay, and the other thing the Fifth Amendment does is, we already saw this very beginning of the course, eminent domain. When we looked at that case, Kelo versus City of New London, right at the beginning of the course, eminent domain issues are covered in the Fifth Amendment. Now the last thing I want to talk about very, very briefly, and we'll see this a few other times throughout the course, so we don't have to cover too much in depth here, is the concept of due process. This is important. This is embedded in the Fifth Amendment. It's also, you also see remnants of it in the 14th Amendment. But what does due process mean? Well, there are a couple types of due process. There's what we call procedural due process, and there's substantive due process. Procedural due process means you are entitled to certain procedural rights if you're charged with a crime. So you have to be given notice of the charges against you. You have to be given the right to a hearing. You have to be given the right to be represented. Right? Some of this stuff should sound familiar, right? Where is it coming from? Those Miranda rights that you hear the policemen recite every time they arrest somebody on TV. You have the right to remain silent. You have the right to an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, one will be provided for you, and so on. All of those are procedural rights that you have to make sure that the government can't just railroad you into jail or depriving you of property, one of the two. They're either going to deprive you of freedom, put you in jail, or they're going to deprive you of property, take away your property. So that's the procedural due process. The substantive due process deals with the rights that are affected. So when we hold these hearings, when we hold the trial has to be held in such a way that it's fair to the defendant. We have to give the defendant the opportunity to present evidence to support his or her case, and it can't be just kind of a kangaroo court that's already decided that the person's guilty and we're just going to go through the motions to make it look like we've had some kind of proceeding. There has to be substantive fairness there. We have to literally give the defendant the rights to do all of that stuff. Now, the Fifth Amendment applies to the federal government alone. It only requires the federal government to give you due process rights. But the 14th Amendment, and I mentioned these two are read together earlier, the 14th Amendment extends those rights to the states. So not only does the federal government have to give you due process rights, the state government has to give you due process rights as well. So the combination of the 5th and the 14th Amendment give you those rights. And by the way, if you're dealing with an organization that is taking federal funding, that organization itself must comply with due process rights. I had a student one time who was being charged by the internal, I don't know what you call it here, but the internal investigators said he did something and they were trying to take action against him. And there was going to be some kind of little proceeding, which I guess in Roger, you know, I'm competent. Competence in legal terms means you're able to practice. I'm competent to show up in front of the Supreme Court of the United States and argue a case. But I'm not allowed to show up in front of the Roger Williams Court that deals with student affairs and argue a case for the student. So I couldn't go in with the student, but he was asking for some help on this. And I was helping him a little bit with some arguments and so on. And they told him that he had no due process rights. Absolutely no rights to due process because Roger Williams is a private university. What do you think? Is that a true statement? Absolutely not. The university takes federal funding in many different ways. So because of those federal funding requirements, they're obligated to give all of you due process rights. So don't let anybody tell you that the university isn't going to afford you due process rights. You're entitled to due process rights even at a proceeding within the university, because the university takes federal funding. So, and remember, that just goes to an issue of fairness. Make sure that you have the opportunity to be heard, defend yourself appropriately, and have the evidence duly considered so that it hopefully will mitigate any adverse impact on you. So that's the Fifth Amendment. Now, the 14th Amendment, and by the way, due process also extends to economic issues. And I used to have people read a case, but we don't really have the time to go into this in detail. Read a case in this class that was a State Farm case. And what happened, somebody got in an automobile accident. And they called up their insurer, which was State Farm, and the insurer said, oh, don't worry about anything. Everything will be covered. So they didn't worry about anything. They didn't do anything. And then the person they hit sued them, and they got a damage assessment of something like $3.5 million. So obviously the people that caused the accident were a little bit upset because State Farm told them everything was taken care of, when in reality now they're out of pocket for $3.5 million. So they sued State Farm and said the State Farm violated duties that they had to them and so on. I won't go into all the details. And the jury came back and said, you're right, State Farm did violate those duties, so we're going to give you actual damages of the $3.5 million that you have to pay to the other party. That sounds fair, right? And on top of that, we're going to give you punitive damages of $145 million. Big number. Really big number. $145 million. Think that's fair? We'll talk about punitive damages and what they're intended to do when we get to torts. But this went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, in a case like that, punitive damages have to be reasonable when they're awarded. And if you have a $3.5 million damage, and you have $145 million in punitive damages on top of that, that violates the defendant, in this case State Farm's, due process rights. Because they obviously did not receive a fair hearing, because they got this judgment that was so far off the mark that it was just absurd. It was just an absurd judgment. So that's what that case stands for. So even the amount of damages is covered under this concept of due process. So when you see these humongous damage awards, don't get too upset about them, because all you have to do is bring up the due process issue, and a lot of times those humongous damage assessments go away. So something to think about there. All right, so that's due process. Now, the other thing that comes in here with the 14th Amendment that's not in the 5th Amendment is equal protection. In addition to due process, which deals with fundamental issues of fairness, equal protection says that everybody's entitled to equal protection of the laws. Should make sense, right? If we have a law, everybody should be required to follow it. And everybody should get the same treatment under the laws. Why? Because we are a rule of law country. Right? We're at the beginning of the course, we talked about the concept of rule of law, where everybody's subject to the rules, including the people that make the rules, subject to the rules. In England, that's not true. The Queen is never subject to the law. But here, everybody is, including the President of the United States. So we have this concept of equal protection, and we don't want to treat different people differently simply because of some kind of characteristic that they may or may not possess. Now, obviously, this goes to some of the fundamental right issues in discrimination. And we'll see this when we get to employment law in a lot more detail, particularly when we look at things like discrimination on the basis of race, religion, sex, national origin, creed, color, those kinds of things. But you can't do it. You're prohibited from doing it. But equal protection has different standards that apply depending on what kind of case we're dealing with. Now, when we looked at civil cases earlier, I think chapter 2 or 3, we looked at burdens of proof, right? And on the burden of proof scale, we have three different burdens of proof. For criminal, we have this beyond a reasonable doubt standard. And that's almost 100%. Not quite 100%, but almost 100%. For most cases, we have this preponderance of the evidence standard, which is just a little bit more than half. And then in some important cases that aren't criminal, we go to clear and convincing. So we have these three standards of proof that apply in civil cases, right? When we're talking about equal protection, we also have three different standards of proof, but we just call them something different. So it's really the same concept, but the terms change. For most cases that where people claim that they're not getting equal protection of the laws, what the courts are going to do is they're going to apply a minimum rationality standard. It's called minimum rationality because the test is whether or not the law has a rational connection to the stated objective. So one example might be, and I'll give you a case that deals with students. These have come up on many occasions. Let's say that you're applying for law school, and the law school has this rating system that gives you points for your LSAT, and it gives you points for your GPA, and gives you points for your student activities when you were an undergraduate student. And it also gives you points if you happen to be members of certain racial groups. So if you're black, you get so many points. If you're Asian, you get so many points. If you're white, you don't get any points. Now, you are a candidate for law school, and you're not a member of any of these groups, and you get rejected solely because somebody of a particular racial classification got extra points because they were a member of that group. You sue for equal protection. This was an actual case a few years ago. A few years ago this happened. You sue saying that it's violated equal protection. Normally what the courts will do is they'll look to see whether or not that standard has some kind of rational connection with the law. But since here we're dealing with a fundamental right, meaning race, religion, sex, national origin, creed, those kinds of things, the court's going to apply what's called a strict scrutiny standard. and it's going to say that there has to be a compelling reason to give somebody preferences simply because they're a member of a particular group. They're a woman, they're a man, they're a member of one ethnic group or another. You have to have some compelling reason to do that. That's strict scrutiny. If it's not a fundamental right, then we're going to be at minimum rationality where we only have to meet this rational relationship. And then in some cases, we'll use that minimum standard, which is quasi-strict scrutiny. That'll apply to rights that are not fundamental rights, but that are important rights. And the best example of that is gender. So if you're discriminating on the basis of gender, and somebody claims that they're not getting equal protection of the laws, then the quasi-strict scrutiny standard will apply. Now this leads us to the Aileron case, the Aileron constructors case. What happened there? What were the facts in Aileron? That was the second case in the constitutional law section. Okay.
The one company had a little bit, but they gave it to a different company because it was like the minority.
Okay. Right. So Aileron has the low bid on this contract for road work. I think it was in Colorado.
Yeah.
They submitted the low bid. Now, the reason the government bids out projects is so that it can pick a person to complete the project on a non-discriminatory basis. Usually, you pick the one with the low price, and that's the one you're going to go with. But we had another company submit a bid. It was called Gonzales Construction, and it was one of the minority businesses, certified minority-owned business. They submitted a price that was higher than Aileron's. The government hired Gonzales, or the contractor, through the government, hired Gonzales, decided to ignore Aileron's low bid, and pay a higher amount to Gonzales Construction to put the guardrails up on the road. The only reason they did it is because Gonzales was a certified minority-owned business. And there are certain governmental policies that give preference to minority-owned businesses. Now, the reason we do this is because traditionally minorities have been excluded from participating in the economic system. And the only way you could expect to get minority groups who have traditionally been discriminated against back into the fold so that they can compete equally with everybody else is to give them opportunities to get these contracts, make some money, so that eventually we can get to a point where everybody's on a pure competition basis again. And we're not looking at race or religion or creed or national origin or any of those things to make distinctions. All we're looking at is who can do the job the best and the cheapest. But in the interim, to get to that point, we have to give those people that traditionally were discriminated against the opportunity to get back into the economic fold.
This sort of goes along with what you're saying. Don't they have something like that too with the businesses run by women?
Yes.
Priority?
Yeah. Women are also considered part of that group. If any ladies in the room, you want to set up a business, you can actually get preferences in some of the contracts because you have a female-run business. So why? Because traditionally females weren't participating in the economic process. So you go back 100 years, it was a bunch of old white guys, right, that were doing this. Nobody else was really running these companies. So we've got to bring all these other groups into the fold so that we can really have true competition and have it based on ability as opposed to some artificial standard. So to facilitate that, to make that happen, the government has these preferences, and they say that when we're bidding out these contracts, even though some company may come in with a low bid, if we have a minority firm that comes in with a relatively reasonable bid, we'll give it to the minority firm to remedy that past discrimination. What do you think? Good deal? Bad deal? What would you argue if you're in that position? You're the company that has the low bid. You're Aileron Constructors. What did they argue? Right, they're being discriminated against. So are they receiving equal protection of the law?
No.
No. They're not getting equal protection of the law. They're being discriminated against because they're not minorities, right? So this goes to court, and the court's going to have to decide whether or not that's a valid claim. Now, is discrimination a good thing? That should be an easy one to answer, right? You don't have to read cases or books to know that. Discrimination generally is a bad thing. So discrimination is not usually good, right? So should we allow the government to discriminate on this basis? And if so, under what basis should we allow them to discriminate? On what basis? Right. Well, the language in the case goes through that analysis that I just talked about. The court ultimately had to apply this, the strict scrutiny standard, because we were dealing with a racial issue. The contract was being awarded simply because the owners of this company were members of a particular racial group. So strict scrutiny standard applies, and that means there has to be a compelling reason for the government to have that policy. And that's a very, very high standard. Usually when we apply strict scrutiny, the government regulation falls because it can't come up to those standards. But in this case, what the court determined ultimately, they didn't determine whether it was okay ultimately to award the bid. They said that the strict scrutiny standard has to apply, and then because the higher court was too chicken to make the decision, they kicked it back down to the lower court to decide whether or not the government reason was compelling enough to justify discriminating in that case. But traditionally what the courts have found in cases like this, where there are programs in place that are designed to give preferences to groups that have traditionally been discriminated against so they can come back into the fold, provided that those programs are temporary and they have a limited purpose, which means eventually they are going to go away when hopefully everybody's back to competing on an equal basis, then we're going to allow it because the government has a compelling need to make sure it protects the rights of everybody, and the only way it can protect the rights of people that have been discriminated against in the past is to make sure they have access to the opportunities now so that they can participate in the future. So that's kind of the analysis the court uses. So that was the Aeron Constructors case. So that deals with that. Now, the quasi-strict scrutiny, remember, just deals primarily with gender issues. So that's that. Okay, any questions on the Bill of Rights issues? No? Everybody got them down? Yeah, we're going to see these again later on in the course. So I want you to know these. You're going to, well, we get, particularly when we get to employment law issues, these things are going to come up again, so you need to know the basics. And we're not just doing this for the fun of it. We're not doing these Commerce Clause rules and things like that as a mental exercise. These are going to be, you're going to need to know these for later on in the course. One other relationship. Let me just test you. See, give you kind of maybe a precursor of what might come next week. Let's say that you have a business and you're dealing with people. Customers, and you're dealing with them in multiple states, and your contract with those customers requires them to go to arbitration. Common thing in business these days. Banks do it. Brokerage houses do it, right? Requires arbitration. We talked about that concept in alternative dispute resolution. Can Congress regulate that?
Yes.
Why? Right. Well, it gives them the ability to avoid it, but in a sense, the Commerce Clause power gives Congress the power to regulate interstate commerce, right? So if you have an arbitration decision, let's say your contract requires you to go to arbitration with this company if you don't agree with the company on some issue, and you don't like the result of the arbitration decision, you bring that to federal court and you say, I want a new trial. I don't like this decision. I want you to decide it, Judge. I don't trust this arbitrator to decide it. Does the judge have to accept the arbitrator's decision? Why? Well, you agreed to go into arbitration, but that's just a contract issue.
Well, the courts, until they accept the arbitrator's decision, no matter what.
Well, they do. Anybody know why? We talked about it when we looked at arbitration. There's something called the Federal Arbitration Act that Congress passed. Congress passed this act that said the courts must honor the decisions of the arbitrators. Can Congress do that? And if so, under what power? That's an exercise of the Commerce Clause power. Any arbitration decision made in interstate commerce is subject to the Commerce Clause power of Congress, and the courts have no authority at all to set aside those decisions because Congress has exercised its power there under the Commerce Clause. So it ties together some of the things we've talked about before. So you might see things like that in the little factual scenario. So remember, on the quiz, it's not just going to be regurgitation of rules. I'm going to give you scenarios and ask you for the result. So you've got to be able to identify what we're talking about, apply the rules, and come to the conclusion. So just remember that that's how the test will be.
Can you just say that last statement again about arbitration?
Sure. In arbitration, what the Federal Arbitration Act says is that whenever a party enters into an arbitration agreement in a contract that's in interstate commerce, the federal courts must honor that decision. They have no choice. They have to accept the decision of the arbitrator. They cannot overturn the decision of the arbitrator unless it's arbitrary or capricious. Okay? And the reason why the courts don't have the ability to do that is because Congress has trumped the court's right exercising its Commerce Clause power. Congress has the absolute right to regulate interstate commerce. So anytime you have a credit card agreement that says you go to arbitration, and you don't like the arbitrator's decision, that's too bad. You don't have a choice. That's too bad. You're going to have to accept the arbitrator's decision because Congress says you have to. That's an example of regulation at the congressional level of interstate commerce. So it's just one application. But remember, you'll see the applied things. So that's why, look at those cases. Look at those cases that we've gone over and the scenarios we've applied, and you should be in pretty good shape. Okay? Other questions?